Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of Isaiah. Today we come to Isaiah chapter 46, talk about idols for destruction. In 1 John chapter 5, verse 21, the apostle closes with these words, "Little children, guard yourself from idols." This is not a stale-dated admonition. Actually, rightly understood, folks, idolatry is no less pervasive in contemporary Western civilization than in ancient times. Idolatry just wears a different, more subtle face in our day, at least in the Western world, and always brings the same embarrassing, not to mention corrupting, results. Life is understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards, which is to say that in the past lies keys to understanding the present. We cannot live in the past, but we must take up its lessons and march more wisely into our future. One writer said, "There is nothing new in the recognition that history follows torturous paths, and that it has forever made a mockery of attempts to predict its course," which is true because most of those who attempt to project the outlines of the future do so without any reference to the revelation of God. The truth is, as events unfold and the tapestry of history takes larger shape, it has followed the lines God revealed in the past, and those revelations yet unfulfilled can therefore reliably be counted on to be as accurate as those in the past. The great reasons why historians, as hard as they may try to understand the forces of history and reduce those forces to laws, the reason they always fail is because they leave God out of the equation. Therefore, they're totally blind to its plot and its predetermined course. In chapter 46, verses 1 through 2, we have the expose of a false hope. Bel has bowed down, Nebo stoops over, their images are consigned to beasts and the cattle. The things that you carry are burdensome, a load for the weary beast. They stooped over, they've bowed down together, they could not rescue the burden, but have themselves gone into captivity. Here we see a continuation of the prophecies of God's judgment upon Babylon. This will not happen for a long time yet. Babylon has not even come into Israel to reduce it to a client state and then eventually to reduce it physically to nothing and exile all of its people. I mean, that's more than a century away as Isaiah writes these things. And then there'll be 70 years of exile until God sends in the Persians under Cyrus to deal with the Babylonians. The prophet foresees, however, the disgrace of the idols of the Babylonians. Bel, that's Marduk, the chief deity of the Babylonians, and Nebo, or Nabu, the supposed son of Bel, and the god of learning and writing. Isaiah foresees them. The Spirit projects him into the future. He sees them as they're hauled away on the burdened pack animals as war trophies by the victorious Persians. He's mocking. These so-called gods have proved totally useless as the protectors of their Babylonian devotees. Far from rescuing the Chaldeans, these gods, Bel, Nebo, they themselves need to be rescued from the backs of pack animals. This punishment of the Jews' enemies is God's work in preserving his people. For the Lord said, vengeance is mine, I will repay, and here he is repaying the Babylonians. But these idols, like all crutches human beings depend on for their sustenance, strength, and survival, are futile props. And in this case, just as our banks in 2009 propped up no one but needed propped up themselves, so these idols need to be propped up. Folks, all human idols will ultimately embarrass us. And you can dead sure count on it, God will sooner or later see to it. Now, I'm defining idols as any and all persons or entities which godless mankind may depend upon for their sustenance, strength, and survival other than the true God. The true God is the God of the Bible. People depend upon money and economic leverage, upon military power and alliances, upon science and technology. That's a big idol today. Upon knowledge and education, big government, you name it. These are things that people look to for our cultural strength and survival, maybe even personal strength and survival. An idol, you see, does not have to be a material object crafted by the art and imagination of mine. It just has to be anything that we depend upon to save the bacon other than God. Ultimately, God always exposes human idols as the futile props or crutches for our hopes that they really are. To trust in them just puts them in God's crosshairs as eventually he knocks those props out from under us and explodes our delusions. That is why the Apostle John warns us in the last verse of his first epistle, little children, guard yourself from idols. It is so easy to let our feet slip onto false foundations of trust. Now in verses 3 through 4 of chapter 46, we have a pledge of God's faithfulness. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. You who have been born by me from birth, you've been carried by me from the womb. Listen to me. Even to your old age, I will be the same. Even to your graying hairs, I shall bear you. I have done it, and I shall carry you, and I shall bear you, and I shall deliver you. This work of divine vengeance upon the Babylonians, when it comes to pass in another 170 years or so from this writing, will be another hopeful sign to the preserved remnant of the Jews at that time, that God is, in fact, watching over them. He may appear to be hidden. He may appear to have abandoned them. But the truth is, they're still the apple of his eye. They are his people. They've been born by God from birth. He birthed them. He's been carried from the womb. Even to your old age, I want you to understand I'm the same. Even to your graying years, I will bear you. I have done it. I shall carry you. I shall bear you, and I shall deliver you. Yes, God will be judging and purging them when necessary, but he will always sustain this elect nation. That has been the case since he brought them into being, and he promises Israel that he will continue to rescue and provide for them in the future. You know, friends, men may fail miserably to live up to their promises and obligations to God, as did Israel. But their failures will never keep God from living up to his promises to his true people. Romans 3:3 said, if some did not believe, that is, did not believe God, their unbelief will not nullify the promises of God. Will it? Of course not. Unbelievers will be purged. But that nation is an elect nation, and that nation will survive. And all of the faithful in that nation, of course, are included in that promise. However severely God may judge the false among his professing people, when you think of a local church, for example, it's a trail mix, and there are always unbelievers in the mix. They will in the end, if not sooner, they will be purged out, sifted out. But all of the church with a capital C, every single member of it, belongs to God. He cares for it. He will keep it. God will never fail to keep his word to the faithful. In this case, he's talking about the remnant or true Israel. On an individual basis, God will do what he did to Israel on a national basis. God will purge and purify us, His individual people. Yet He will preserve us and perform His promises. Again and again He will test our faith. He will leave us in positions where it appears that either He is not going to deliver us or is unable to. In those cases, circumstances always invite us. Circumstances even urge us to run up the white flag, to give up on the Lord, give up on Him doing what He promises, and tempts us to jerry-rig our own solutions, which only make matters worse in the long haul. It's a great story of that in 2 Chronicles, where Asa, the king of Judah, faced a great threat. And instead of trusting in the Lord, he tried to work out his own political salvation with Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. And as a matter of fact, his strategy worked. But it was not God's strategy. And the Lord told him in 2 Chronicles 16:9, "My eye runs throughout the earth to find a man whose heart is whole toward me. Herein you have done foolishly. Henceforth you shall have wars. There's a way that seemeth right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." God tests us, and there's always the temptation to do things our way instead of His way. But those who do things His way, His faithful people, He preserves, and He supports, and He carries in His loving arms. Well, in verses 5 through 7, the prophet mocks handmade gods in which men, not only pagans, but in this case, even the people of Judah, were seduced into worshiping. "To whom would you liken me and make me equal or compare me that we should be alike? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh silver on a scale, here's what they do. They hire a goldsmith. He makes it into a god. They bow down. Indeed, they worship it. They lift it on the shoulder and carry it. They set it in its place, and it stands there. It does not move from its place. Though one may cry to it, it cannot answer. It cannot deliver him from distress. Idols are helpless and inert without human helpers and initiatives." Let it be perfectly clear that Israel's God is not like handmade idols of the pagans and whom the faithless in Israel worship in their folly. Israel's God made Israel, but mere men made their idols. These idols are the product of their own human art and imagination. Such mute deities cannot save themselves in time of trouble, much less rescue their worshipers, which reminds us how absurd it is to trust in a God that you create for yourself. How absurd to trust in something smaller than you are or someone infinitely inferior to the true God. Think about it. Everything that human beings depend upon for their sustenance, strength, and survival is in some way a creation of their own making, or is someone or a combination of other humans, all of which amount to material idols and have the same function. Yet they are God's substitutes who are immeasurably inferior to God, and none is remotely able to fill the bill of a deity. So in verses 8 and 9 he says, "So let God's rebellious people come to their senses and get it fixed in their heads and take it to heart. There's one and only one God, the living God, and none compares to Him." That is to Yahweh. "Remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things long past, for I am God. There's no other God. I am God. There is no one like me." Go back. Read your history. "Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things which have not been done. I'm the one saying my purpose shall be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. I'm sovereign. I call a bird of prey from the east. There's Cyrus again, though not named. The man of my purpose from a far country. Truly I have spoken. Truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it. Surely I will do it. Listen to me, you stubborn-minded, who are far from righteousness. I bring near my own righteousness. It is not far off. My salvation will not delay. I will grant salvation in Zion and my glory for Israel. If God is God, let Him be God. And if He is not God, let's stop the charade." Verses 10 through 13, the proof of the true God. It comes down to prophecy and performance. Time and time again, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has revealed in the plainest language His future works to His prophets. even far in advance, and then he proceeded to perform them just as he said. So the logic is there's no true precedent for that kind of revelation among the Gentile gods. But this pattern of revelation on the part of Israel's God proves that he, their God alone, is all-knowing and all-powerful. And to separate himself from such heathen vanities, Yahweh has from ancient times foretold the future in very specific terms, so that the difference is obvious. Not only that, but he has demonstrated his sovereignty and his unthwartable power by performing his plan just as God said he would. Friends, if you want to know that there is a God, just read the book of nature and see his handiwork. It beggars the imagination to think that there could be intelligent human beings educated to their gills who could actually bring themselves to imagine that all that we see, and so much that we don't see, in this creation, in all of its order, complexity, precision, and beauty, is the result of spontaneous combustion, so to speak. It is counterintuitive, so much so that it makes one wonder about the intellectual sanity of otherwise brilliant exponents of Darwinism. It only goes to show to what extremes sinful humankind will go to avoid the supposition of God and escape, if they can, God's restraints upon their moral behavior and escape anybody putting upon them the yoke of accountability. If you want to know that the God who is the necessary creative intelligence behind all this intelligent design in what we call the cosmos, then go to the scriptures and its prophecies. There's nothing in scale and scope that compares to it in the whole world of religious literature. And as for future prophecies, here's our security. As the past is the best indicator of the future, we can depend upon those prophecies yet unfulfilled to be performed as advertised. God has never failed us yet, and he never will. Those in Israel who missed the train of trust will be, in the end, shamed and humiliated. Those who turn to other gods, so-called, the Lord declares to these faithless that he's working out his righteous plan willy-nilly, with or without them, and it will soon be accomplished. His salvation of his people will not, in spite of their unbelief, be thwarted nor delayed. In restoring glory to Israel, God will, down the road, shame those who could not muster any trust in him, but turned elsewhere to those nations and gods who could not help. In chapter 47, verses 1 through 7, we have a word about the myth of being too big to fail. Come and sit down in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon, sit in the dust without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no longer be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind the meal, remove your veil, strip off the skirt, uncover the leg, cross the river. Your nakedness will be uncovered, your shame will be exposed, and I will take vengeance and not spare a man. Our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, is his name, the Holy One of Israel. The timeless principle of what I call the moral constitution of the universe is right here. Babylon is put forward as Exhibit A. This is a taunt song against the pride of Babylon, which foretells her humiliation as the Lord steps in to take unsparing vengeance upon her for her cruelties to God's people. What applies to the nations also applies to individuals. Even the pagan Greeks understood that human hubris is a setup for a knockdown, and that's a redundant theme of Greek tragedies. Nations and humans who want to play God will eventually get reduced to a clod. Babylon, like a deposed queen, will suddenly go from the penthouse to the outhouse, Isaiah prophesies. Though the Lord was angry with his people, remember it hasn't happened yet, but it will. Though the Lord was angry with his people and turned the Babylonians loose on them to punish them for their sins, the Babylonians showed them no mercy and despised them, and in doing so, despised their God. The Babylonians showed them no compassions for their own contempt of them. They thought nothing of the consequences of their excesses and just considered that they had no accountability. Well, they were wrong about being able to do as they pleased because they occupied the top of the mountain. They thought there was no one to take them down. Wrong. In verses 8 through 10, we have the myth of being unaccountable. Babylon has acted arrogantly and presumptuously, as if she were God himself, saying to herself in her wanton security, I am, and there is no one else to disturb me or punish me. You who dwell securely, who says in your heart, I am, there is no one besides me, I will not sit as a widow, nor shall I know the loss of children. None of those bad things will ever happen to me. You thought no one was watching you. God says to Babylon to hold you accountable. No one sees me. You pride yourself in your wisdom and knowledge for which you are renowned. Let me tell you something. They've deceived you, and now you will pay the piper. Whenever people and nations get too big for their britches, you can count on them splitting their britches. Whenever people get too big in their own eyes, they develop this idea they are above the law, even God's. They get this notion either God doesn't see because they think he doesn't exist, or they get the notion he doesn't care because they get the idea in their heads he's indifferent, or they have this idea that he even approves because they somehow think he favors them. Whatever the case, they do not take into account the great patience of God with sinners. And when at last God determines to step in, they find he was seeing them all along and not liking what he saw. God is omniscient. He sees everything. God is patient. He holds his fire, giving time and space for repentance. But in the end, he is holy, and he holds arrogant transgressors accountable. Well, in verses 11 through 15, he talks about the myth of powerful magic. The Babylonians were known for their occultic arts. Evil will come upon you, which you will not know how to charm away. Disaster will fall on you, for which you cannot atone, and destruction about which you do not know will suddenly come on you. Stand fast now in your spells and in your many sorceries with which you have labored from your youth. Go ahead, perhaps you'll be able to profit, perhaps you'll cause trembling. You are wearied with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers and those who prophesy by the stars and those who predict by the new moon stand up. Let them save you from what'll come upon you. They become like stubble. Fire burns them, and on it goes. You've been dancing with the devil, and you're about to discover how deluded you've been by the devil. None of your magic arts or occultic rituals by which you so famously claimed to ward off danger or injury is going to spare you. I will take vengeance. Disaster and calamity will come suddenly and swiftly upon you, and you'll not be able, you'll see, to conjure up any magic to make a bargain with the devil that will save you. You've been sold a bill of goods in the devil's infomercials. The Billy Mays of hell has told you this magic stuff is the ticket. Well, the devil has tripped you up. Now you're about to find out that this stuff doesn't work when the adversarial power of God comes calling. Folks, this is a good reminder that we too live in an era of neo-paganism. It's coming back with a roar. I don't think I need to tell any of my listeners that we live in a so-called post-Christian age. That is, when Christian influence are no longer culturally dominant influence. That is very true. And people are drifting into atheism more and more. Many have been closet atheists all along, now feel the freedom to come out of the closet without backlash. And there are many who are relapsing back into paganism with its occultic practices, rooted in magic rituals and the guidance of psychics. It's all demonically inspired. It's deceptive and deluding. The Babylonians were into it big time. Eventually, the overwhelming power of God will expose it for the evil it is and for all of its deceptions. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.